edition of his book Naming Names, which I'll tell you a little bit about in just a couple of minutes. Victor Novasky has been the editor of The Nation since 1978. The Nation is the weekly magazine of liberal analysis and commentary. It's been in publication since 1865. Novasky is a former editor at the New York Times. He's also the author of Naming Names. This is a study of the ethical questions confronted in Hollywood in the 40s and 50s during the period of blacklisting. Novasky describes the book as being less a history than a moral detective story. Through interviews, he explored what motivated HUAC witnesses to perpetuate the blacklist by providing the names of their colleagues and how they feel now about their complicity. Novasky also pursues the conflict felt by many who were blacklisted, the conflict between the desire to punish and the urge to forgive. Novasky is a visiting professor at Swarthmore College this semester. He's teaching a weekly class on repression and resistance and leading a weekly symposium on subjects such as McCarthyism and Reaganism. Victor Novasky, welcome to Fresh Air and congratulations on the American Book Award.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
We'll be talking about some of the issues and questions you raise in Naming Names, but first I'd like to talk about some other issues that I know of concern to you. How do you think the conservative administration in power now is affecting organizing on the left?
Well, I think the first thing to say is that the left is no different from everybody else. So despite last month's slowdown, prices are higher than they ought to be, and more people are out of work, and the prospects of nuclear exchange are more frightening than ever. And our meddling and muddling in Central America could have all kinds of repercussions domestically to people on the left, right, center, up, down, and both sides. So the left is no different in that respect. As far as organizing goes, they have given the left an enemy. And the first, I think, kind of test case of what the Reagan administration has done to or for the left will come on June 12th when there will be a rally on the nuclear issue. And the one gathers from reports in various papers that the skirmishing and battles among the sectarians on the left are raging as wildly and unhappily and bitterly as ever in the organizing leading up to that rally. Nevertheless, I think it's going to be a spectacular event, and all won't be forgotten at it, but that it's going to work in a way that will maybe the beginning of something. And part of the reason for that is that it's not just the left. It's the interaction of the left with the mood of the whole country.
Well, I think one of the images is that the left always argues amongst itself more than the right does, that there's more agreement and more acceptance of what the line or the point of view is going to be than on the left, where everybody's like quarreling with one another and there's always different factions. Do you think there's much truth in that?
Well, it may be true this week, but I think that the coalition that put Reagan in is headed for a real split, and that ultimately there is not a natural alliance between the neoconservatives, for example, who are have a large Jewish component in their membership, and the moral majority, which has a large anti-Semitic component in its membership. And ultimately the laissez-faire conservatives of the Milton Friedman school have little in common with the evangelical conservatives. So how the libertarian right and the traditional right and the new right fare in the next couple of years is something that we haven't seen yet, but my suspicion is that whatever battles there are on the left are going to be equaled and maybe surpassed by what lies ahead.
A couple of months ago, there was an evening of speeches in support of solidarity, but this was mostly people on the left who were speaking, and it was an answer in a way to the Let Poland Be Poland program that the government produced. And one of the speakers was Susan Sontag, and her remarks, I think, continue to be very controversial. Everybody from everybody on the left and on the right seemed to be writing editorials based on what she said. One of the things that she said that you quoted in The Nation, because her speech was reprinted in The Nation, was, imagine, if you will, someone who read only the Reader's Digest between 1950 and 1970, and someone in the same period who read only The Nation or The New Statesman, which reader would have been better informed about the realities of communism? The answer, I think, should give us pause. Can it be that our enemies were right? And that's a quote again from Susan Sontag. What did you think of what she said? Did you agree with that?
Well, the first thing I thought of what she said is that she didn't read The Nation during those years, because one of the ironies about The Nation is that during those years, it depends which half of the magazine she read. The back of the magazine was run by a very brilliant, fierce anti-Stalinist woman named Margaret Marshall, and all of the reviews in the magazine and political cultural essays reflected that. Front of the magazine was run by Frieda Kirschway, and later on by Carrie McWilliams, and they had a different orientation than Margaret Marshall did. But the point is that The Nation was, in those years, a pluralist publication. So her image is skewed. Secondly, I did take the trouble to go back and look at the Reader's Digest during those years to see what I had missed after her town hall speech. And I found articles like, Why China Will Never Split with Russia. These kind of scare pieces about the red menace within by J. Edgar Hoover and other people who were really misleading the American people and fanning the flames of what has come to be known as McCarthyism by portraying this monster, this within that really didn't exist. So it's certainly true that a lot of writers for The Nation and a lot of people on the left misunderstood the nature of Soviet society during those years and therefore did not appreciate the what was happening to people who were living there and didn't understand the nature of Soviet imperialism. But to go to the Reader's Digest for solutions seemed to me an act of demagoguery. We nevertheless were pleased to print Susan Sontag's article. I called her and asked her if we could, because what we wanted to do as well was to invite our own people and others in and around the magazine to comment on it. And because she said more than that, she also tried to argue that there is no real difference between communism and fascism, and that it has taken her many years because she, along with many others on the left, said that she had inhibited herself from criticizing Stalinism or communism because she thought it would feed the forces of domestic reaction. And she's come to recognize that basically communism is fascism with a human face. And so we invited people who range from Diana Trilling, who really has little political sympathy for The Nation these days, although she used to be a fiction editor and wrote many pieces for the magazine back in the 40s, but ranging from her to Philip Green, who was the head of the political science department at Smith College, who's at Princeton this year, and many others. And they, I think it's good reading because people haven't debated this question in a long time, and it's mirrored in a different debate that arose when the new Reagan State Department started talking about the difference between authoritarian and totalitarian regimes. And I think the most useful thing that came out of it from the point of view of The Nation was an essay that Jacobo Timmerman wrote, in which he made, in a very moving way, kind of the point that you can't you got to criticize evil where you see it, and that to hang these tags on it doesn't help advance the fight against it and the fight for human rights. And I hope everybody gets to read that.
Well, do you agree with one of Sontag's premises, which is that the left has been very wary of criticizing communism since the right is already taking care of that, and since so many of the American government foreign policy is predicated on protecting countries from communism, that if you come out against communism on the left, that you're playing into the hands of American foreign policy that you actually disagree with? Yeah.
Well, no, I don't agree with that. I think if she had said that people on the left were late to criticize the Soviet Union, that would have been one thing. But to talk about communism the way she did, it seems to me, is to confuse rather than to advance the discussion. I mean, who's communism? What does it mean? I mean, the Karl Marx's communism or Rosa Luxemburg's socialism or what's happening in Yugoslavia or what's happening in China, or what's happening in Cuba. It's and also to make this argument about which is worse, communism or fascism, assumes when you have that kind of discussion that the real answer to all our problems is something called capitalism. And it's in an unreal universe. I mean, I think there is a kind of an ideal of democratic socialism that it motivated a lot of important advances in the human condition, and also that got perverted into awful things like death camps and purges and some of the other kind of manifestations of social evil that communist countries, so-called communist countries, were no less guilty of than fascist countries. But it doesn't, or it didn't for me, it wasn't an illumination to be told there's no difference. I think it was destructive in a way, because there is a difference between people who are committed to a theory of racial superiority and violence as a solution to man's problems, from a theory which is basically an egalitarian theory, from each according to his ability, to each according to his needs. It may be in practice that you can't do it that way, and that's important to understand if that's true. But then the questions are, why can't you? Can you not do it that way in a country the size of the Soviet Union with its history? Do you need a smaller country? Do you need a different history? It's just it's too easy, and it may also, despite all of the attention that it's gotten, which we contributed to, have been the wrong speech at the wrong place, because the purpose of the gathering at Town Hall, at least as envisioned by its organizers, but they take their risks along with everyone else, and it's a free country, and Susan Sontag should have been able to say whatever she pleased. But their idea was, as implicit in what you said in your opening remarks, that this was to be a gathering of people who wanted to show their support for the solidarity movement in a way that was different from what they regarded as the exploitation of the solidarity movement by the Reagan administration on behalf of its own continued Cold War with the Soviet Union. This was going to be a kind of a different set of ideas. And as the organizer of the rally, a fellow named Ralph Schoenman put it afterwards, he said, "She hijacked my meeting."
Well, there's
more power to her, though. So
there's a suit against her now. I should reintroduce you first. Victor Novasky is my guest, the editor of The Nation and the author of the book Naming Names, and the paperback edition of that just won an American Book Award a couple of days ago. There's a suit against her now. You reprinted her text with permission. The Soho Weekly News, I believe, called her up, asked her for permission. She said no, and they printed it anyways, I think with the understanding that it was an excerpt of a news event. And she sued them. They've since gone broke and folded. What did you think of her suit?
Well, I thought she shouldn't have sued them, because in the unlikely event that she wins, she's continued the suit after they went out of business, because the company was insured, presumably, and they could still collect from the insurer. But she shouldn't have sued them, because if she wins, it's bad for National Public Radio, it's bad for The Nation, it's bad for The New York Times, it's bad for the small end nation because it will have a chilling effect on the desire and ability of editors and reporters to report what happens in public meetings. So that's number one. Number two, I think it was bad public relations on our part to sue a struggling paper like Soho. It makes for titillating gossip, and nothing is gained by it. And then on the merits, I think to try to assert copyright over, a speech that is made at a meeting which is open to the public, in advance of which the organizers go to extra pains to try to recruit media to cover it. They succeeded in getting the Pacifica radio stations to put it on this. I think it may have even been the National Public Radio satellite. I don't know how those things work technically.
I think it was broadcast. It was sent through the satellite, right. And then other stations could make up their own mind about whether to put it.
It was, I know that another paper had taped it because we were offered the tape of it. So to take a public event like that, the purpose of which is to have public resonance, and then to sue somebody for publishing what came out of it seems to me also contrary to reasonable expectations. And then finally, I would add that I think if the New York Times had chosen to excerpt the whole speech, she would have had no objections. And it's really picking on a small quasi-counterculture operation. I doubt that Susan Sontag would have sued the New York Times. She claimed that she submitted her article to the Times and they had accepted it for publication, the op-ed page, and that the Soho thing killed it. And that we'll see about I'm told that the op-ed page hadn't accepted it. They had turned it down, in fact, but whether that's true or not, the lawsuit will determine. Now, I have another reason for being interested in this, which is that the Nation itself is the target of a copyright suit, and some of the same issues are at stake there. We think we have an easier case even than Soho does, but nevertheless, it's unpleasant to be on the receiving end of a copyright suit. That involves First Amendment issues. She is claiming, by the way, in her suit against Soho that she copyrighted her speech and therefore they shouldn't have been allowed to use it without her permission. They're claiming it's a public speech and therefore is protected under the First Amendment to the Constitution. We at the Nation in 79, I guess it is. It's a while ago. Someone leaked to us a copy of President Ford's forthcoming memoirs, and I read them, and they were pretty boring, except for one chapter on his pardon of Richard Nixon. And in that chapter, it seemed to me he made admissions that, taken out of the context in which he put them and put in the real world context, led me to believe that there was a high probability that there had been an obstruction of justice involving President Ford and then Vice President Ford and then General Alexander Haig, who was serving in the White House. And we ran a story about that potential obstruction of justice in The Nation as a front page story, in which we quoted a couple of hundred words from his memoirs. And about 5 or 6 months later, Harper and Row, which at the time made a lot of noise about our story and threatened to sue us, actually sued us. And they claimed that we had violated the copyright on the book by quoting these few hundred words out of a book of some hundreds of thousands of words. And the case is in federal district court in New York right now. The specific issue that we reported was that, according to President Ford himself, one day, Haig came to him and said, "Hey, we have the smoking gun tapes. We've got to persuade Mr. Nixon to resign. And there are five different ways we might do it." And he listed four of the ways. And then he said, "And the fifth way would be if you would promise to pardon him when you became president, maybe he would agree to resign. And Ford, in the book, says so. I then said, is it possible to pardon an individual who hasn't yet been indicted? And he said, Haig told me, yes, we checked it out with a White House lawyer. Ford then says, I went home, and next day I mentioned this conversation to one of my aides, and he said, what did you say? Ford said, I didn't say anything. The aide said, that could be a time bomb. And he mentioned it to another aide, and the other aide said, oh, that's very dangerous. So finally he said, I called Haig and read him the following statement. And then he publishes the statement in the book. Nothing that I said yesterday or you said should be interpreted to mean that we made any kind of deal on the pardon. Well, in The Nation, we reprinted this statement. Our argument is, and we reprinted other memoranda that Henry Jaworski, who was the prosecutor and the special prosecutor in connection with Watergate, had one of his aides had written to Jaworski. Our argument is that those documents are public documents and that former presidents can't withhold those documents for private profit at their own pleasure. These were arguments and conversations and memoranda that were written by public servants conducting public business on the public payroll, typed on public typewriters by secretaries getting paid public salaries. So we have as much right to publish that material as Ford does. We weren't interested in taking his prose. We didn't, as Soho did, I think, innocently with Susan Sontag, we didn't just take a chapter the way they took a speech. We picked and chose, and we did take a few hundred words. And so that's the issue that we're being sued over. So we, in court, in federal district court in New York, brought in expert witnesses on the question of what is news, and because that's one of the big issues. If it's news, you cannot copyright the news. That's our argument. Their argument was, no, you took his property. And we say it can't be his property if it's news. So our witnesses were Fred Friendly, who used to be the president of CBS News, and David Halberstam, who wrote a book called The Powers That Be about the news business, and Richard Reeves, who used to be a media commentator and has worked for 25 years as a reporter in print and on television and et cetera. And they had the difficult task of describing to a not particularly sympathetic judge what news is, in their view anyway. I think the law, the facts, and justice are all on our side, and we'll see which side the judge is on when he hands down his verdict in a month or two.
What would happen if you lost?
Well, they're suing us technically only for $12,500, which they claim is the amount of money they lost when Reader's Digest, when Time magazine did not publish a serialized part of Ford's book, which they say was the same part that we chose to write a story about. And so the first thing that would happen is we would lose $12,500. Second thing they would try and do would be to collect lawyers' fees. And by our lawyers' estimate, we have the American Civil Liberties Union and Floyd Abrams, who's a great First Amendment lawyer, working free of charge for us. They volunteer their services because they think there's an important constitutional issue at stake, which is our right to write about public affairs and public officials and public issues of that great moment without having the threat of harassment by these multinational corporations. But by our lawyers' estimate, they have so far spent to collect their $12,500 over $150,000 in legal fees. So they would then attempt, Harper and Row and Reader's Digest, to collect for their lawyers, their astronomical Wall Street law firm overhead fees. And if they succeeded in that, that could be very damaging to us. We don't think they will succeed in that. Our lawyers tell us that even if they won the case, which is a closer thing than that, the law seems to be quite clear that in order to collect legal fees, you have to have registered your the copyrightable work within 3 months or 90 days of the alleged infringement. And for reasons unknown to us, their lawyers didn't get around to registering their Ford's book until after the 90-day period had expired. So we think they can't collect legal fees regardless. But they're arguing that they can't. So
Victor Novasky is my guest. He's the editor of The Nation, the publication involved with the lawsuit that he was just describing. And he's also the author of the book Naming Names, which has recently been published in paperback and, as a matter of fact, just won an American Book Award. The Nation organized a Writers' Congress last fall, in which writers from around the country, both freelance writers, novelists, journalists, came and talked about the pros and cons of organizing a writers' union. Are you for a writers' union? Do you think that would be a good thing?
Well, I personally am for a writers' union, although I have to say that the Congress discussed a lot of other things. The union was probably only about 10% or less of what was on its agenda, although it was the single issue that excited most of the delegates there at a plenary session. They broke out and started singing Solidarity Forever when the issue of do we support principle of union came up. But I have to say, even though I personally am for it, that the first union organizing committee that developed in connection with the Congress drafted a proposed set of rules for the union, and high on the list was that no editor should be allowed to join because it is, after all, writers' union, and that's the class enemy. The editor is the class enemy. Well, what happens if, like me, you're an editor who is also a writer? So they're now debating should there be associate categories and all that. So I have felt that I shouldn't play a role, a real role in organizing the thing, because it just is odd in that respect. For it would be an odd thing for an editor to do, but I'm proud that the nation had a part in bringing everybody together where this thing might happen. And indeed, there are organizing committees around the country of writers that I think would have happened eventually without the Writers' Congress, but maybe we helped to speed things up just by bringing people together at a propitious time.
So do you think there will ever be a writers' union in the near future, in the next 10 years? So?
Well, there are writers' organizations all over the place. And the word union is the kind of odd one. The in California, for example, there is the Writers Guild West, which represents screenwriters, and they make hundreds of thousands of dollars as a result of their guild. It's called a guild, not a union. One of the reasons, it's a peculiarity of the law, that writers don't have a union is that most lawyers tell them when they ask, or tell one when one asks, that a union is a writers' union is a violation of the antitrust laws. And you say, well, how can that be? And what they say is that under the antitrust law, a writer is an independent contractor, and that the difference between an independent contractor and an employee is that an employee does not control his work product, whereas an independent contractor does. So that, for example, a screenwriter turns in a screenplay, the producer can take it and throw out the first half, hire someone else to rewrite the second half, change the male lead into two women, change the locale from Israel to Nazi Germany. There's no limit to what the producer can do. And whereas a book writer, they can't do that to us. We can withdraw our book, but they can't tell us what we're going to say in our books. They can make suggestions, and ultimately they can say, we won't publish unless you make these changes, but it's a different tradition and a different relationship. So if the price of having a union is that writers have to give up their right to control their work product, then I think there won't be a writers' union because there are very few writers who want to do that. On the other hand, if that is a correct interpretation of the law, and I think there's a big if there, and it's been tested in some courts in different ways, but it can always be tested again. But if it turned out that that's what the law said, my argument would be, so change the law. There's nothing in our Constitution which makes it that way. Some language got into the antitrust laws, and there's no good policy reason why writers shouldn't be allowed to have a union like everybody else. There are a whole set of services that writers need and don't have. For example, freelance writers don't have medical insurance. Now, there are organizations like the Writers Guild and PEN and others, that American Society of Authors and Journalists, that offer different plans. Some of them are better than others. Some don't have plans. But that's an important form of insurance to have. So novelists don't have libel insurance. And that's an important form of benefit to have. There is no such thing as a minimum wage for writers. The Authors Guild did a study in conjunction with Columbia University last year, and they found that the average writer in this country earns $4,000 a year. There are a whole set of other issues that a union or an organization could make a difference for its could help its members to achieve. And in California, for example, there is a group called the Media Alliance, which represents not merely writers but many people in the media community, and they have won for writers from a number of local news organizations minimum wages for freelancers. For example, if somebody writes more than a certain number of articles per year for the same publication, that writer gets a higher rate per article than someone who just contributes one time only. And that policy was negotiated by the Media Alliance on behalf of the writing community with a set of news organizations out there. Something of the same thing was done with the Village Voice in New York. So is it a union, isn't it? Can you have a writer strike? What does that mean? If will someone who has worked for 5 years on a book refuse to have his book published if the publisher doesn't take out libel insurance? Well, probably not. But on the other hand, a lot of writers might tell their publisher, other things being equal, they'll go elsewhere unless they adopt some of the humane, obviously needed reforms that other publishers have found that they can adopt. Would it be a closed shop? Could I not publish my book if I didn't want to join the union? Would the union be a conservative or a radical union, or would it be non-political? Well, all those things to be decided, but I think there is enough sense that there are things that writers need that no existing organization gets for them, that there will be something, whether it'll be a national or a bunch of local or regional organizations with some kind of loose confederation at the top. Who knows?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Victor Noveski is my guest, the editor of The Nation and the author of the book Naming Names, just published in paper by Penguin, and it's won an American Book Award. And I'd like to get around to talking about some of the issues that you bring up in that book. What was it in your personal history that made you that interested in not only the climate of McCarthyism, but what motivated the people who did testify before you act to name names?
Well, I don't know that it's a matter of personal history, other than that I did have friends whose parents had been victims of the Hollywood blacklist. And I did, actually, now that you mention it, I worked in a summer resort in 1951 or two, where in the Adirondacks in New York State, where one of the guests was a man named J. Edward Bromberg, who was an actor in the old group theater. And he had been subpoenaed by the Un-American Activities Committee, and his doctor had given a certificate saying that he couldn't appear because he had some kind of heart disease. And he came up to the mountains to after he didn't appear. And while he was there, two FBI men appeared, and their purpose was to see whether he was engaging in water sports and doing other things that would prove that he was could appear. And indeed he was swimming, and he was eventually did a little bit of summer stock, and they went back, and he was re-subpoenaed, and his doctor gave another certificate saying, "Hey, just a minute, there's a difference between frolicking in the water and playing chess and appearing in summer stock on the one hand, and appearing before a committee of the Congress where the stakes are your ability to earn a livelihood if you don't cooperate, or the necessity of betraying your friend, because the litmus test at that point of your ability to work in Hollywood if you were accused of having been a communist was your willingness to go before one of these committees. And first of all, if you had been, to say you were and that you're sorry, and then they would ask you who else, and you would have to name who else. And if you didn't, you were declared in contempt of Congress. Or you could refuse to do that and take the Fifth Amendment, in which case you would be blacklisted and couldn't work again. Or you could take the First Amendment, in which case you would be cited for contempt of Congress and, like the Hollywood Ten, perhaps be sent to prison. So it was an awful dilemma. And they re-subpoenaed J. Edward Bromberg. He went back and this time did testify. He took the Fifth Amendment. A few months later, he went to England and he died of his heart disease. And I went that winter to the memorial service for him, and I was very moved by what had happened. But one of the speakers was Clifford Odets, the great playwright of the group theater who wrote Waiting for Lefty and Awake and Sing and other plays of the 30s. And there was all kinds of muttering and crying, and I understood part of what was going, and yet there was an undercurrent that I didn't understand. I mean, I understood why there should be such great sorrow, and that Bromberg was perceived as some kind of political martyr, and yet I really didn't know there was something else happening there. And it wasn't until years later that I discovered that Clifford Odets, who gave the eulogy at J. Edward Bromberg's funeral service, also named J. Edward Bromberg before the House Committee on Un-American Activities. So there was that set of unanswered questions that I was interested in. I had done a lot of reading about I'd always been interested in the McCarthy period, I should say, and I went to Swarthmore College as an undergraduate and got out in 1954, which was the year of the Army McCarthy hearings. And instead of studying for my honors exams, I remember sitting and watching, riveted to my television set, and taping the actual summary speeches of the Army McCarthy hearings. But I had read a lot about what happened in Hollywood and the blacklist, and there was one thing I couldn't understand, which was how so many decent, honorable, smart, talented people who also had a strong streak of idealism, which had gotten them involved with the Communist Party in the first place. I understood they later, a lot of them got disillusioned, but nevertheless, they cared enough to join something, whatever their misunderstandings of it were, how those people could end up what on the surface looked like an act that doing something that was unconscionable and indecent, which was to betray their friends, to save their own careers at the price of their friends. And the odd thing was that in all of the literature about that period, there's a big gap. There were books, very good books, about the blacklist, a book by Steve Canfer called Journal of the Plague Years. There was an early book called Hollywood on Trial, written at the time of the thing. There were memoirs by various people who came through it. Alva Bessie, one of the Hollywood Ten, wrote a memoir. Another one, Herbert Biberman, wrote about his efforts to make Salt of the Earth. Later on, Lillian Hellman and others wrote the memoirs. But no one had ever gone to the informers, the people who named the names, and asked, why did you do it? And how do you feel about it now? So I was interested in doing that. And so one thing led to another. And I also have the theory that if you're going to do a book and spend 2 or 3 years of your life, it ought to be something you're interested in, and you ought to be paid to do something that you want to do rather than something that you think is going to sell or anything like that. And so I was fascinated by that, and I went and did it.
I should think that most of the people who did name names did it mostly out of fear of, like, losing their job, not being able to support their family. Were those mostly the reasons?
Well, it's hard to know. I mean, of those I spoke to, there were four different kind of themes that emerged in the conversations. And one of the themes was, yes, I was a victim of the terror. I couldn't help myself. It was not stated as quite that. A second theme was also shared in this thing of I don't want my family to suffer. It was that I was operating. I had a set of higher obligations than the obligation not to betray a friend. Either my obligation was not to let down my family. I was the sole source of support for my family, or in some cases, in the case of Bud Schulberg, he said, you know, you think you're a civil libertarian for fighting the blacklist. I was fighting something worse. I was fighting Joseph Stalin's death list. And I discovered that all these people that I had revered as a young communist, and he had gone to the Soviet Union to a meeting of the Writers' League over there, or a meeting of an international writers' congress, had become non-persons, and they had been sent to the salt mines or Siberia. And I would prefer not to have gotten called up before the Un-American Activities Committee, but in terms of who is the greater evil, Stalin was a greater evil than McCarthy. Well, my answer to that to Bud Schulberg is, well, Bud, yeah, but you can denounce Stalin without doing it, without strengthening the forces of domestic reaction, which goes back to the Sontag debate a little bit, that someone in your position could write books about it, you can make speeches about it, you can give money to organizations that are fighting and exposing the nature of Stalinism. You do not have to betray your friends in order to make that point, and you do not, you know, they're different issues, it seemed to me. So that was a second kind of thing. One, I was a victim of the terror of the times. The second, that I was operating in accordance with some higher principle. Third thing people said was, they deserved it. That maybe I shouldn't have done it, but I'll tell you something. They were so much worse than what I did. What they did to me when I was in the party was so much worse than what I did to them by naming them before this committee that it's not a serious question you're asking me. And Kazan, the director who directed Arthur Miller in Death of a Salesman, his plays Death of a Salesman and All My Sons, and who directed, interestingly, On the Waterfront, which is this movie where, as you remember, Marlon Brando comes to maturity when he realizes his obligation to Fink on his fellow hoodlums on the waterfront, which was written by Bud Schulberg, who named names, and starred Lee J. Cobb, who named names. He says, as one of his, although he says he doesn't want to talk about it, he then always talks about it a little bit. And one of the reasons he gives for doing what he did, or one of the things he says, whether he calls it a reason or not, is that they betrayed him when he was in the party, and they betrayed the ideals that they were supposed to stand for. And he gives as an example that in the group theater itself, which the party had a caucus, and that the theater would vote on who should control the selection of plays, and all the communists would vote as a bloc. And they would vote in the interest of the Communist Party rather than the interest of the group theater. And that kind of thing. And eventually they kicked him out of the party. And so he felt personally embittered and wounded. And he gives that rather than he wasn't trying to save his career. He could have worked on Broadway and he understood that and all that. It's his reason for doing it. And again, I mean, it seems to me revenge is it's a dubious social motive. You can't tell someone they're not entitled to their revenge, and yet you do not have to do it through the agency of a committee like the Un-American Activities Committee, which wrecked so many lives, and in concert with the McCarthy Committee, the Eastland Committee, and all the state and local committees, and the FBI, and the whole internal security apparatus, really tainted the atmosphere and of this country, the political culture of this country for many years, and we still don't understand all the ways in which it affects our assumptions about how the world works and ought to work. So that was a third reason that they got their just desserts. And then finally, they would say something which wasn't really a reason as to why they did it, but almost without exception, everybody I spoke to threw in, and by the way, they already had the name, so I wasn't hurting anybody. Well, on the one hand, it turned out to be truer than they understood, because the committee in the hearings began in 47. In 1955, they called as a witness a man who testified that he had been simultaneously the membership chairman of the Communist Party in the Los Angeles area and a police spy for the Los Angeles Police Department. And at the end of every year, he would turn over 1,000 names to the LAPD, which would share them with the FBI, which would share them with the Un-American Activities Committee. So they did have all the names, but the fact was that until your name was mentioned out loud, you didn't lose your job. And by naming the names out loud and going through that ritual, I call it in naming names a degradation ceremony, but by doing that, what you ended up doing was reinforcing their right to ask and making it that much more difficult for the next person to refuse, and conceding that it was okay for our state, which is supposed to be a democratic state, to have as its test of virtue your willingness to betray your friends. And that test is one which totalitarian societies is characteristic of totalitarian societies. Indeed, in the Soviet Union, we learned that the first two questions they asked in the Purge was who recruited you and whom did you recruit? But we're not supposed to do that. And so that was the fourth kind of theme that came. So I didn't find any of the justifications given adequate to the circumstance. And one of the problems in writing about this is that people say, oh, so what you're saying is that these are bad people and they're evil and all that. And then I quickly say, well, look, I'm saying something different. I tried to ask, what is the right thing to do under the circumstances? Now, there were some very good people who did the wrong thing, and there were some awful people who did the right thing. And I think that's a meaningful distinction, but it gets lost.
What does it mean?
Well, it means that I'll tell you a way that it came out. Years later, Dalton Trumbo made a speech when he received the Laurel Award, which is the highest award that writers in Hollywood can bestow on their peers. And this is after, and he said on that occasion, in the late 1960s, Blacklist presumably died by 1960. He said, well, actually, it may have been after late 1960s. Well, but it was about then. He said, those of you who are too young to remember The Blacklist should study it because there's a lot to learn. But when you do so, don't look for heroes and villains because none of us was without sin. There are only victims. And it was received at the time as a very healing and generous statement. But when I went out there to do research on first for an article and then my book and talked to Albert Maltz, who was another one of the Hollywood Ten, he greeted me with a statement denouncing Dalton Trumbo, saying, to say that there were only victims, that were equally victims of the people who named us, is to take away the meaning of our lives. What do we go to prison for? It's like saying the guard and the prisoner at the concentration camp are both equally victims. And Trumbo wasn't saying that at the time. At the time, he was saying, he wrote a pamphlet called The Time of the Toad, and he was saying these people ate toad meat, that they were the scum of the earth. Well, I took Maltz's statement to Trumbo for a comment, and Trumbo said, you know, Lillian Hellman says that forgiveness isn't my job. That's for the man upstairs. He said, well, I feel the same way about vengeance, that it's an unhealthy thing. And Kuroji said, and I can't say that a man who named names because the committee was going to reveal his homosexuality at a time when that was the greatest social stigma one could have, that I could tell him to do otherwise. I can't say that the woman who named names because she was the sole support of an infant whose husband was in prison and who had herself been abandoned as a child, I can't say that that woman should have risked abandoning her child by taking the course of action that we took, which was to go to prison. So what it means is that you have to look at each circumstance in and of itself, and that you have to be a little humble in the face of what would you do if called up there. And so that's...
Probably a lot of people who did give names to UAC didn't really know the extent to which lives would be ruined by the blacklisting. Now that that's all history and they saw exactly what the results were, did many of the people who did name names feel guilt or remorse?
Some did and some didn't. I spoke to one fellow who is the producer of many of the movies we see on late night, or the series we see on late night television, The Rockford Files and others. And he told me that he said as soon as he had done it, he was ashamed of himself. And he said that he went up before the committee thinking that he would not have to name any names because they already had all the names. And he had spoken to the investigator. He said, I don't have any new names to give you. The guy said, don't worry, I'm not going to ask you to volunteer any names. He said, but when I got there, what they did, he said, was they asked me, did you know so-and-so to be a member of the Communist Party? He said, and the record doesn't show, but I paused for 5 minutes before thinking, should I say yes or no? He said, and he said, the terror, and he was the one who used the phrase, the terror was upon me. He said, I was willing to be a hero and jump off the cliff for something that I believed in, but I had quit the Communist Party 10 years earlier. I had a wife and two children and a sick mother to support. We were at war in Korea. The communists had taken over, had come to power in China. The Russians had gotten the bomb. The Hiss and Rosenberg trials had made national headlines. He said, I was a victim of the territory. So I said, yes. He said, then they said, how do you, did you know Smith to be a member of the Communist Party? Yes, he said. And I said, how do you spell it? He said, that's where I drew the line. I refused to spell the name. And I went and looked it up, and sure enough, they asked him about eight names. Each one he refuses to spell. Smith, Jones, each name up there. And that was his little protest and his holding on to a sense of himself. And it's kind of the ultimate pathos of that situation that someone was reduced to that. Now, he is so glib about denouncing what he did that you say, well, it's a little easy. It's to say, yeah, I shouldn't have done it. Then what? What follows in that? Well, as it happens, this fellow, Roy Huggins, has gone out of his way to hire a lot of blacklisted people and did so before it was the thing to do. He just made it a policy and has remained relatively politically articulate and other things. But it's still a question.
I guess life is a lot more complicated than you'd like to think sometime when you just try to neatly sort things out and come up with theories to explain things that happen.
Yeah, once you get finished going through all this and showing these shades of gray and pink and orange and all that, I felt that it was important for me anyway to not shy away from the business of saying what I thought was the right and the wrong thing to do, because the most important thing may be that there were people who knew how to behave when it counted. And Hellman is a very controversial woman, and on the left as well as in the larger community. I agree with Murray Kempton about her, who wrote that, you know, she knew what to do when it counted. That was her summit. You know, she got up there and she said, I would be happy to tell you about myself, but I will not bring trouble to innocent people. I cannot cut my conscience to fit the fashions of the day. Or she put it more eloquently than that. But she did do what was right when it counted at personal sacrifice and risk. And those actions may be important, not just as learning experiences if you study them, but because they make it difficult for it to happen again in quite the same way, because these people function as exemplars, as moral exemplars.
Well, we are in a period that has been called the New Cold War. Do you think that a new blacklisting period could emerge?
Well, I think I have the beginning of a theory about what's happening, but I don't think it'll happen in the same way. There are lists and other things, but no, I don't. And I think one of the reasons it can't is precisely because there were people who resisted and prevailed, and so they showed us how to behave. They showed us it can be done. And also, the media has learned a lot, and the media, I think, was complicit in helping it happen last time, and it can prevent it from happening in the same way. On the other hand, I think if one thinks of if one arbitrarily takes the period that I took, which starts basically after the Second World War in 47, and thinks of those investigating committees as phase one of some continuing form of repression or however you want to characterize it, what was characteristic of that period was the stigmatization of people for their political beliefs or their previous political beliefs through labeling them communists, fellow travelers, subversives, or whatever. And then the society jumped into the act and made sure that they couldn't work, that they were social outcasts, that their children were suffered in school from having been associated with parents who had done this awful thing of joining the Communist Party in the 30s, for whatever motives. And that lasted, at least through I guess the time for me when that period symbolically was over was when one of the Chicago six or seven or eight were called, I guess it was Abbie Hoffman, and he appeared in a red, white, and blue T-shirt and refused to answer the questions of the committee on the First Amendment. And when the judge asked him if he had anything to say on his behalf, he said yes. They had ripped his shirt off going into the committee. And he said, yes, I regret that I have but one shirt to give for my country. And they really laughed the committee out of business. I mean, Jerry Rubin appeared in the Santa Claus suit. They just, they exposed this thing for what it was. They couldn't, maybe one could or couldn't have done that back in the early 50s. But it showed that phase one was over. What we learn, however, is that through the Freedom of Information Act and also various tort actions that have been brought against the FBI and other federal agencies, that at about the time the committee lost its power to punish through stigmatization, The FBI had begun its counterintelligence program called COINTELPRO, which did directly what the committee really did indirectly. They would infiltrate organizations, black organizations and others, and they sent a note to Martin Luther King suggesting that he commit suicide and did other things. And the COINTELPRO was much more vicious, although out of sight, than what the committee was doing above ground directly. And I think now we're in a third phase. And the third phase is the legitimization of that which just a few years ago was thought to be so shameful that it had to be done outside the law and was officially denied. Now the Heritage Foundation has a report out that the Reagan administration has adopted as its legislative program to let the unleash the CIA domestically, to make legal wiretapping, bugging, placing informants in anti-nuke organizations and other things which a few years ago were unthinkable. And the question is, what comes next? If that happens and you legitimize all these techniques which are fundamentally outside our system of values, and that is where 1984 comes in.
Well, with that, we're out of time. I want to thank you very much for telling us about your points of view on a number of different issues and your new paperback edition of Naming Names. Victor Novasky has been my guest. He's the editor of The Nation, and his book, Naming Names, about the McCarthyism in Hollywood and about the psychology of the people who did name names, has just been published in paperback by Penguin, and it just won a national, an American Book Award earlier this week. He's a guest professor this semester at the, a visiting professor, that is, at Swarthmore. And thanks again for talking with us.
Thank you.
It's a minute to 5 o'clock. We'll be joining National Public Radio for All Things Considered in a minute. I want to remind you that tomorrow morning at 10, we'll be providing live coverage of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee hearing on strategic nuclear balance. There will be two witnesses, both former defense secretaries, James Schlesinger and Harold Brown. Again, that's 10 o'clock tomorrow morning. Tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air at 2 o'clock, my guest will be futurist and economist Hazel Henderson, the author of a new book, Creating Alternative Futures, The End of Economics. Drazana Beverly, formerly of the cast of For Color Girls, will be with us at about 3. Bill Van Wert, a film critic, 3:30. And social ecologist Murray Bookchin at 4 o'clock, who will discuss radicalism and anarchism and the traditional left. That's at 4 o'clock, and I hope you can join us then. Contributing to this afternoon's Fresh Air has been Frances Davis. The technical director today was Lorraine Aragon. The production assistant for the program is Maeve Magora, and the associate producer is Danny Miller. My name is Terry Gross. I want to thank you for listening, and I wish you a good evening. This is WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. Stay tuned for All Things Considered.
Support for this program comes from the NPR News and Information Fund. Contributors include the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, for Midwestern coverage, the Joyce Foundation, for historical reporting, the Pew Memorial Trust, and the Chubb Group of Insurance Companies, business and personal insurance underwriters worldwide. This program is a production of National Public Radio, which is solely responsible for its content.
Good evening. From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Susan Stamberg.
And I'm Sanford Unger, with All Things Considered.
Culture is not a static thing. It is not a little suitcase filled with frijoles and tortillas and a little Mexican cowboy suit. It's not so, you know, people say to me,